Mr. Waxman?
Good morning, Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court. For more than 100 years, the distinct character of college sports has been that it's played by students who are amateurs. Maintaining that distinct character is both pro-competitive, because it differentiates from professional sports, and can be achieved only through agreement.
That's the lawyer for the NCAA telling the Supreme Court of these United States what allegedly makes college sports so special. The concept of amateurism. But yesterday, in a landmark decision, the highest court in the land ruled against the NCAA, jeopardizing its ancient rules against paying college athletes and its ancient notion of college sports itself. Today, Jay Billis explains how we all got to this point and where we're headed next. I'm Pablo Torre. It's Tuesday, June 22nd. This is ESPN Daily. Jay Billis, I am so excited to talk to you today, of all days, on a day you've been anticipating, I feel like, for a while. Where were you when you heard about the Supreme Court's ruling in the case of the NCAA versus Alston?
I was on an airplane flying to Los Angeles when I saw the ruling, and I read it on the plane while I was being offered some almonds by the flight attendant, and read it, and really, Pablo couldn't believe it.
Jay Billis is an ESPN college basketball analyst and practicing attorney who's criticized the NCAA's approach to paying players since he was a player at Duke himself.
Not just that it was a 9-0 ass-kicking by the Supreme Court of the NCAA, but it went so far. The Supreme Court of the United States basically invited future litigation and sent a signal that the NCAA is a serial antitrust violator. And not only were their rules on what you can provide to an athlete on the academic side violative of federal antitrust law, but every other rule they have that limits athletes' compensation violates federal antitrust law. So I was really sort of surprised.
I'm also just confused. I want to get the basics straight from you because you're the mind I need here. What did the Supreme Court do today?
Well, let's start a little bit further back to get to now. So in 1984, the NCAA lost a case in the United States Supreme Court. It was called the Oklahoma Board of Regents case. So Oklahoma and Georgia sued the NCAA because the NCAA used to tell all the member institutions how often they could be on television. And some of the schools didn't think that was fair. They thought it was, they could make more money if they were allowed to cut their own TV deals. And the NCAA, in their infinite wisdom back then, thought that if all the games were on television, nobody would go to the games anymore. And all these schools would lose their most valuable property, which were gate receipts. So when they lost that case, it opened up the ability for all the conferences to make the money that they're making now because they have their own individual deals. Now, in that ruling, there was what's called dicta, where something was stated in the ruling that wasn't central to the decision. And it was that amateurism is basically a bedrock principle for the NCAA, and it distinguishes the product from professional sports. It was just a throwaway line. I think most legal observers felt that's what it was at the time, but a lot of courts used that line to protect the NCAA and their rules on amateurism. So fast forward to today, the Alston case was about one thing. It was a federal antitrust claim, and it was about, can the NCAA limit what an athlete can receive from his or her school on the academic side? So if a school wanted to give a scholarship and a laptop and a paid internship and a postgraduate scholarship, right now they're not allowed to do that. Jeffrey Kessler was Alston's attorney. And I know you know the name.
I do.
And maybe know him personally, but Kessler is formidable. Like he has beaten the NFL. He's beaten the NBA. He wins all the time because he's good. And it was his judgment that this case should go forward just on the limited basis of academic benefits. So wasn't asking for the players to be paid, wasn't asking for name, image, and likeness, because that would send it back to the trial court, and this would take forever to resolve. So he wanted relief for the athletes now, and also kind of in the civil rights area, kind of like Thurgood Marshall did years ago, chip away at it. And that's what happened. You know, the NCAA was again found to have violated federal antitrust law. But the court went further. So they said that throwaway line in the Board of Regents case was dicta. It doesn't mean anything. And they said so now. So now no lower court can use that line as justification to allow the NCAA to continue to do what they've been doing. And it also signaled that this is a big business, and they will not get any deference from the courts going forward. And that's bad news for the NCAA, because now they're like the rest of us. You know, they can't go out and violate federal antitrust law without getting called on the carpet for it and without being sued for it. And Justice Kavanaugh went even further and basically said that if this were any other business, it would be clearly illegal. They can't just say that the public wants a product played by unpaid players, therefore that justifies us not paying the players. Because that's really what they're saying. Really sort of an evisceration of the NCAA's position, and about as big an ass kicking as you're going to get. To me, what it signaled is a couple things. One, we're going to see a bunch of lawsuits, maybe even tomorrow, that the policies on compensation violate federal antitrust law. So I think that's coming very soon. I think you're going to see the NCAA stop dead on name, image, and likeness. They're not going to pass any legislation themselves, because anything short of full economic rights is going to be seen as violating federal law. And they're gonna go back to Congress and get on both knees this time and beg Congress to bail them out of this situation they've created. And I don't know what Congress's appetite for that's going to be. It's an unholy mess that has been a long time coming, that some of us saw coming, and that is a direct result of incompetence on the part of NCAA leadership. To the NCAA's credit, they milked this pretty well over the years, and they've had a pretty long run. So the fact that it's over now, and it seems like it's somewhat abrupt, and it's really not over now. I shouldn't say that. It seems like it's ending abruptly. There's still going to be a lot to be decided going forward on how this happens. The NCAA is not going to go away. Multi-billion-dollar businesses don't fold up because they have to pay their employees. They're going to be just fine. And oddly enough, The collective bargaining is what could ultimately be the answer here. That if the NCAA will collectively bargain with the college players, then they're taken out of antitrust law, just like the NFL or the NBA is. We're not going to see the NCAA go away. They're not going to say, you know what, CBS, keep your billions. And all, you know, the SEC is not going to.
Right. ESPN. Hey, it turns out we still want to do business with you guys. That would be something we're interested in.
Yeah, and guess what? Dabo Swinney ain't going to quit either. Like when he said, there's too much entitlement in the world as it is, so as soon as we pay the players, I'm out. I got news that he ain't going to quit, and Ohio State's not going to go to Division III. We're not going to see Amherst versus the Buckeyes at the Shoe on a Saturday with free admission. They're going to stay where they are, and the world's going to stay on its axis. It'll be just fine.
So the NCAA, because we're talking about antitrust, I do want to explain for those who are not as initiated into this entire discourse, Jay, like, what is the NCAA really? Like, a corporation, a nonprofit, a governing body in the market, as we understand it, of college sports. What's its role such that it would be in this position to have what turns out to be a monopoly?
It's a great question. It's a cartel. So it's an umbrella organization of you know, some people might think the NCAA is one big league, and it's not. It's a collection of competitive leagues. So what the NCAA is sort of an umbrella organization or a governing body of a bunch of competitive leagues that compete against each other for money, for attention, for media dollars, for players, for coaches, for administrative talent, all that stuff. And just like OPEC would agree to fix prices on oil so they could, you know, control the supply and control the price of oil worldwide, that's what the NCAA is doing with regard to player wages. They're price fixing the players' wages. And so my question has always been, when people would say players get a scholarship, that's their pay. But more non-athletes than athletes get scholarships. Mm-hmm. Yet those students aren't limited in what they can earn or accept in their chosen field. Like, if they're getting a scholarship, why aren't music scholarship students limited in you know, whether they can cut a record or whether they can play at a local bar, whether they can write a song that turns out to be a big hit? They can accept all that money, and it doesn't affect their status as a student. The only thing the NCAA should be doing, and I think the court said this today, certainly Kavanaugh did, the NCAA can require that every athlete is enrolled and a full-time student in good standing. After that, you got to play ball with the rest of the world on business principles and the antitrust laws. Now, the concurring opinion that went further by Justice Kavanaugh really undressed the NCAA and said, you know, you're not above the law, even saying law firms couldn't collude together to limit lawyer salaries, you know, and base it upon love of the law. And you know, kind of, you know, really gave them a hard time about the idea that you can't say that it's somehow central to your business, that consumers like it because the players are unpaid, therefore the players have to remain unpaid. That's absurd.
I love the idea, though, now that you mention it, of other industries having... What if we lived in a world where they did try to borrow the NCAA rhetoric? Like, do you guys really love management consulting, or are you doing this because you're a naked capitalist who wants to destroy the purity of management consulting? Like, it's just farcical when you put it in those terms.
Yeah, and you know, Andy Schwartz, who's a great economist and has spoken on this for years and years and been way ahead of the curve, pointed out, you know, this a long time ago, saying that if shoe companies that, you know, somehow, you know, use sweatshops or something, said that, well, the consumers like shoes that are made by unpaid labor, therefore it's justified in the marketplace, they'd get laughed out of court. And it's the same thing with the NCAA. And now that veil has been lifted. And the signal is very clear, is that if one of your rulings goes against this and comes up to us, we're going to overturn it. This is now precedent and the law of the land, and it extends beyond this narrow sort of ruling on, you know, academic benefits. It is easily applicable to other areas of compensation, and it's not a hard logical leap or legal reasoning leap to get to name, image, and likeness, and to get to whether a school could sign a player to a contract if that school wanted to.
All right, Jay, after the break, I want to talk about the chill that has been now crawling up the NCAA's spine and what this ruling means for the very concept of amateurism in college sports in the first place.
When you're on a business trip, you know what completely goes off the rails? Your workout routine, especially when you book a hotel that doesn't have a gym. So what ends up happening is you do a few push-ups and sit-ups in your room, run around the block, or just skip it entirely. Lame. If you just stay at La Quinta by Wyndham, you'll discover there's a fully equipped fitness center at every location. Now you can wake up and power your buys and tries the right way, or de-stress with some cardio. The choice is yours. Tonight, La Quinta. Tomorrow, you shine. Book direct at LQ.com.
So, Jay, for those who don't know your legend, I mean, you have been the guy with the megaphone on this issue for how long now? How long you've been talking about this as a former player and a lawyer yourself?
I started talking about it when I was in college, when I was a member of the NCAA's long range planning committee, except I talked about it more in meetings rather than publicly, because I didn't want to be seen as going against the machine. But it really started when I became a broadcaster for ESPN and decided that, wait a minute now, you know, I'm a lawyer, but two, I'll talk about whether this rule on the floor is right or wrong. Why am I pulling punches with regard to NCAA policy? That's what we do. We cover it. So when there's a court ruling or something, we talk about it, we cover it. So I started talking about it, and nobody at ESPN told me to shut up. So I kept doing it. If they told me to shut up, I would have. It happened in the 60s, it happened in the 70s, it happened in the 80s, and it's happening now. So do people really think that you know, when the FBI uncovered some wrongdoing, that you know, football's just handing out one pair of socks and a jock and that's the end of it? Of course they're not. And like, people want to watch the sport, and they want to watch it played at the highest level. Nobody complained when there's been drastic change on the revenue generation side. Like, nobody said, well, wait a minute, I'm not watching college sport. I'm not watching college sports anymore. If they're going to sell these games for billions of dollars, I'm not doing it.
I'm not going to watch college sports if Alabama's locker room looks like a spaceship. No one has said that.
Bingo. And nobody said, I'm not putting up with a game that pays a coach $10 million a year or pays the strength coach over $1 million. You know, old timers at these rubber chicken lunches, they'd ask about the changes and everything. I say, hey, look, if I were a senior in college right now and I was at this event, like in 1986, where I was a senior, and I told you someday you're going to pay Coach K $9-10 million a year. In 1986, they would have said, nope, we'll never do that. I will say, that's not what this is about. That's not what Duke's about. We will never do that. That's not what college sports is about. Well, we're doing it. And nobody has a problem with it.
Right.
I don't have a problem with it.
No one's on their fainting couch because Mike Krzyzewski is now a corporate titan as well as a leader of young basketball players.
Right. He can be both. And that's sort of my point, is that money and love of the game and money and education are not mutually exclusive. That's been proven. The money keeps going up, and it's going to keep going up after this. And even when players are paid, it's going to keep going up.
So just the NCAA's self-defense, Jay, like just the defense of amateurism as this governing principle, it seems rooted in obviously a romanticism. How do they make the argument that, in fact, this is a principle worth defending? Because as explained, it seems so transparently fraudulent.
Yeah, they don't anymore. And the Supreme Court pointed that out, that there's no definition of amateurism that the NCAA has ever stuck to. And amateurism means whatever the NCAA says it means at any given time. And that's literally true. So they can, at first, back in the early 1900s, players weren't allowed a scholarship. That was considered a violation of amateurism rules. Then they were allowed a scholarship, but not anything else. And then they were allowed a scholarship and a stipend. So it changes all the time. And the NCAA has even been under oath. Mark Emmert said, if the players are allowed to do commercials, they'll be nothing more than shills for products and professionals. So how do you square that now that the NCAA claims to want to give them NIL rights? That means that they're going to be professionals. So if they're going to be professionals, why should you limit them in any way? They've tried to say over the years that amateurism is this love of the game. You know, you have to play for the love of the game, all that crap. And now they've given up on that. And now they're just arguing that you can't be an employee of the university because that fundamentally changes what college sports is all about. These schools are multi-billion dollar entertainment conglomerates. And they teach school too. That's great. But, you know, the NCAA tried to say during the pandemic, well, the kids want to play.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. I mean, I'm sure they wanted that to happen. But the truth is, a lot of non-athlete kids wanted to do their thing too, but they weren't allowed to.
Yeah. The first violin chair at Stanford also wanted to have a concert. But guess what? That didn't have the same level of priority, it seemed, administratively.
Right. The NCAA member institutions and the conferences owed content to their media rights partners, meaning us.
Mm-hmm.
And they weren't going to get our money unless they delivered that content. They're in the entertainment industry, in addition to being in the education business. There's nothing wrong with any of it. It's all fine. But we ought to just call it what it is. And I think for the most part, the Supreme Court in the Alston ruling called the business what it is. It's a multi-billion dollar entertainment business, and they have to operate by the same rules as every other business.
You had mentioned that part of the understanding of amateurism had been chipped away at by name, image, and likeness, this catch-all term describing athletes' efforts to basically get the right to profit off of their identities, their social media accounts, autograph signings, spokesperson deals, et cetera, et cetera. Like, explain your understanding of NIL and then how this intersects with the Supreme Court ruling we got today.
Okay, I think you have to go back on NIL, back to Ed O'Bannon and the O'Bannon case, where the NCAA used to put out video games with their media rights partners, EA Sports and 2K Sports. So they had football and basketball games. And I actually was the voice of one of those games for a period of time.
Oh, I remember, Jay. You haunted the college dorm common rooms of so many young Americans.
Have the ball up to 10. What are we in for with these guys, Jay? An intimidating defensive team, Mike. They really like to force turnovers by putting pressure on the ball, getting out in passing lanes.
So sorry about that. In order to do that, I had to go into a sound booth for a couple days in LA and do all that work on the game. But it included an entire day of saying this incredible list of first names and this incredible list of last names. And the last names included Hansbrough and Odin and things like that. You know, so Tyler Hansbrough. And so what the game used to make people do is they would have the player look exactly like the player in real life.
Yep.
Same build, same body, same color.
Literally, the measurements would be replicated.
Everything.
Yes.
Everything. Same number. And then the user would go in and put the player's name in on their own. And that was kind of the legal fiction that they used, that somehow that was not the image of the player being sold by the NCAA. But the truth is, the NCAA didn't care because they didn't think anybody would call them out on it and it would be a problem.
You would have prepared the vault of all of the name possibilities that exist for the actual players, and then you'd enter a name, and just coincidentally, Jay Billis had already articulated perfectly each of those names, first and last.
Right. But one of the things that I asked him about, I said, why do you have generic coaches in this? Players are all identical to real people. The coaches were generic. So the Duke coach didn't look like Coach K.
Mm-hmm.
And the Georgetown coach didn't look like John Thompson. Like that didn't happen. So I asked them, like, why don't, and they said, well, we'd have to pay them. And then I'm going, aha, okay, now I get it. So instead of turning the faucet on, the NCAA just turning the faucet on as it is for everyone else, they're arguing about how many drips the players should be allowed. So now it's going to be up to Congress. What is Congress going to do? Because I think the NCAA is going to slow down to nothing and see what happens. We're going to have name, image, and likeness, but I think it's going to be state by state. And I believe we're going to find that the world will remain on its axis. You won't see boosters offering players a bunch of cash because people don't do that. What you're going to see is people will offer a player a contract. And that contract's going to be exclusive in most cases. And then players are going to stick around the school that they choose because they want to remain getting paid rather than jumping all over the place, which is, you know, people fear right now. So I think it'll normalize things in the long run. It'll be a pretty simple, pretty straightforward business, just like coaching is.
That's right.
But the NCAA has kind of pulled the wool over our eyes for all these years, kind of scaring people that you know, everything's going to fall apart if we give the athletes more than a scholarship. It's all going to go away. Women's sports is going to go away. We're going to start cutting sports left and right. They said the same thing with regard to the stipend, and none of it happened. And I don't anticipate that anything bad is going to happen here.
Do you think there's any second guessing going on at NCAA offices in Indianapolis about the strategy that they chose to pursue? Well, big picture, but even more narrowly in this particular Supreme Court case.
Yes, I think the NCAA realized they had screwed up. It seemed pretty clear to most observers that it was not going to go well after the oral argument. But this was a colossal screw up by Mark Emmert and Donald Remy. And what does the Board of Trustees do? They extend Emmert out to 2025. When you look at the colossal failures that Emmert has had as president of the NCAA, and they are too many to count here. The fact they're on Capitol Hill all the time, the outrageous amount of money they've spent on legal fees trying to defend their. So if you have to spend this much to defend your principles, maybe your principles aren't so hot. And and like, this wasn't just one wave. This is a tidal wave that has been coming for a long time, and the NCAA's seen it and they've ignored it. And because I love basketball, college basketball so much, and basketball in general, what I would prefer is for the NCAA to have run their business the right way this whole time. I don't think it was that hard. They haven't done it. So the fact they're being made to do it doesn't seem to me to be that big of a deal. It would just be more comfortable if they would have done it themselves and admitted that this is not the Little League World Series. And in fact, the NCAA tournament every year makes more than the damn Super Bowl. And the players should be allowed to monetize it. When I give those rubber chicken speeches at times, people ask about this, one of the things, and I have to update the movie, but I used to say, look, if your kid was Macaulay Culkin in Home Alone, mm-hmm. and the all the movie studios colluded together and say, hey, listen, we're going to give these kids tutors and feed them and make sure they've got medical care while they're on the set, but we're not paying them. We're all going to agree we're not paying them. And you know, Home Alone comes out. Do you think you, as a parent of the lead in that, would say, well, that's good by me? You'd go, screw that. We want our money. And I feel the same way about athletes. Like, if they're old enough to sell and they're mature enough to sell for billions of dollars, they're mature enough to realize upon their value.
But now I have the mental image of Mark Emmert recreating the face Macaulay Culkin makes on the movie poster of Home Alone. Jaw agape, hands on the sides of his cheeks, truly just like in a state of, I would imagine, some degree of panic, Jay, despite the contract. So as we look ahead to the next year here, like, what is this going to look like?
Yeah, well, first, Emmert would not be the Macaulay Culkin character that, you know, screams when he puts Aquafaba on his face. After shaving, he would be Joe Pesci that needs to be hit with a shovel before he wakes up to the reality of the situation.
Yes, falling, by the way, in that metaphor, into an elaborate series of traps that are also foreseeable by a child.
Exactly. That's exactly right. This is way better than I expected when I brought that up.
Yeah, we're workshopping this and it's working out pretty well. Yeah,
I'm impressed. How's it going to look? I think there's going to be some uncertainty at the beginning because the athletes can make a few bucks. Now we're worried about the uncertainty and what's this going to look like and how are we going to control it? Why do we have to control it? Who says you have to control it? But it is going to be an adjustment to see players in commercials during timeouts. You know, like right now, you have to watch Clowns Like Us. You know who's going to lose?
Jay, it's just hit me.
Pablo,
it is just
we're
hit
gonna
me.
Lose money.
Yeah.
We're the ones that are going to lose money. So because the players can't be paid, you know, during March Madness, a clown like me would have a commercial
mm-hmm.
because we're the only ones they can get.
Yes, you're the face that could profit off of your name, image, and likeness. That you are the one who can do that.
Right, and that's going to go away.
I'm lower on the ladder than you. I should confess here, my plan to eat exclusively Wendy's in an attempt to steal your marketing dollars, it feels like the time has run out on that plan.
It's not going to pay off for any of us, but at least then we'll have an honest, straightforward business instead of the way we're doing this now.
Jay Billis, a Hall of Fame bloviating gas bag, I thank you. I thank you sincerely.
Well, it's the least I could do, Pablo, and we'll be together not doing commercials into the you know, sailing off into the sunset now.
Just eating burgers together, Jay, for the love of the game.
Paying for them and paying for them.
That's right. That's right. All right. Up next, how one NFL player casually made an enormous bit of history.
Now let's talk about the play of the week. The pressure to follow up Hypnotic and Cognac weighing heavy on the team. Hypnotic was in the cup, blue, and ready for the play. And boom, Añejo Tequila came in with a smooth assist to Hypnotic's tropical fruit finish. Shaken, strained, poured, it was green and good. The playmaking splash shifted the tempo. Another great cocktail from the Hypnotic team. Every season is Hypnotic and Tequila season. Hypnotic Liqueur, Bardstown, Kentucky. 17% alcohol by volume. Hypnotic reminds you to think wisely, drink wisely.
Here's another story I want you to know. If you happened to be scrolling through Instagram last night and this video Carl Nassib posted randomly started autoplaying, you might have just scrolled right past it. Because the Raiders defensive end didn't have some dramatic intro or theatrical reveal or even a tone of voice that declared, at long last, that this profound piece of NFL history was being made.
What's up, people? I'm Carl Nassib. I'm at my house here in Westchester, Pennsylvania. Just want to take a quick moment to say that I'm gay. I've been meaning to do this for a while now, but I finally feel comfortable enough to get it off my chest.
Now, to be clear, Carl Nassib is not the first gay NFL player, but in a sport that has existed for roughly a century now, he is the very first active player to be publicly out. And part of what felt almost startling about this entire thing was how laid back, how casual his declaration was. Like, it was not a big deal.
I really have the best life. I got the best family, friends, and job a guy could ask for. I'm a pretty private person, so I hope you guys know that I'm really not doing this for attention. I just think that representation and visibility are so important.
So let's make no mistake here. Carl Nassib's announcement is an enormous deal. It's a big deal because even though women's leagues like the WNBA and the NWSL all feature a number of LGBTQ athletes, in major men's sports, there's really not any representation at all. It's a big deal for fans who may have reasonably wondered what it says about their favorite sport if no gay man playing it has ever felt comfortable enough to be themselves in public. It's a big deal for other athletes, active or retired, players like Ryan O'Callaghan, who was a former lineman with the Patriots and Chiefs, who was so worried about coming out that he nearly took his own life. And it's a big deal for kids, for LGBTQ kids, a population of young people that, according to a study Nassib cited, attempt suicide 40% less often if there is just one accepting adult in their life. And there are not nearly enough adults like that, not in America, not even in 2021. According to the Human Rights Campaign, more than 250 anti-LGBTQ bills have been introduced in state houses across the country this year. So many of them targeting transgender people across sports and otherwise. Which is why Nassib also announced that he's partnering with and donating to the Trevor Project, a nonprofit that provides suicide prevention services and support to LGBTQ youth. But as for where Nassib's story goes from here, that's kind of up to the rest of us. Because as casual and comfortable and confident as he was in his video, none of this is actually that easy. Carl Nassib himself wants none of this to even have to be a thing.
I actually hope that like one day videos like this and the whole coming out process are just not necessary. But until then, you know, I'm going to do my best and do my part to cultivate a culture that's accepting, that's compassionate.
And yeah, we should do the same. I'm Pablo Torre, and this has been ESPN Daily. I'll talk to you tomorrow.